You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello in the Radio Maria studios here in Toronto, hosting the program today, Ask the Lawyer. Today we have in our radio studio, we have our friend and colleague, Vince DeAngelis. Vince, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
And Vince is here. Every once in a while we can coerce Vince to come in. Not really coerce. He's happy to help us out. And we're here to talk today about wills and estate planning issues, a program that, of course, or the theme, I guess, that people find particularly interesting and important on an ongoing basis. And when Vince was in the studio last time, we had quite a long-standing review of wills and powers of attorneys and different issues. And I know from the local coffee shop, although people are always afraid to call in, we always have people who approach me and tell me that they really appreciated the information, which is always, of course, makes us feel good that people are listening and learning something at the same time. And we wanted to remind people that if they did want to call in, it's area code 416, phone number is 245-1534, area code 416-245-1534. We're always happy to discuss, and any comment that's made is never stupid. People always are sometimes afraid to make comments. They think they're stupid. Actually, they're not. From the simplest of comments, sometimes we get the most interesting discussions. And the same thing would be true if people are listening to a rebroadcast of this on their podcasts or whatever. They can always send an email through to the Radio Maria studios, and those messages will be passed along to us, and we're happy to answer any questions. And as we said, no questions is stupid at all. Never think that way. Knowledge is power, as they say, and it's a good thing to know about things. So, Vince, today, relating to the wills and estates planning, there are so many different issues that come up, and we often, of course, we preach, you know. It's like going to Mass every Sunday, you know. We preach about the importance of wills and powers of attorney and estate planning, and we see it all the time. And yet, there are a lot of people who fail to do that kind of planning. And a lot of people, especially a lot of people from Europe, who traditionally have had this opinion that they never have to do wills in particular, because at the end of the day, it's all provided for in the law and it's going to go to their spouses and their kids. And they're used to a European system where that sort of would follow. And people maybe traditionally have tended not to do wills and so on and so forth. But here in Canada, we really, and I was going to say here in Canada, but in North America, we have a little bit, let's say we do things a little bit differently and becomes more formalized, because unlike the European system, which has a forced heirship regime, here in Canada, we really have the opposite as a general principle, right? You can leave your assets to whomsoever you wish. You don't have to leave it in general terms to your children or nephews or nieces or whatever. Sometimes even to your spouses. I had an interesting case in this past year where we had a couple who had no kids, and they each wanted to leave their estates to whomsoever they wished. This was their desire. It was quite an interesting case, and And they were a more elderly couple. We ended up having to do, believe it or not, a what we call a marriage contract or a domestic contract and have separate representation and so on. There was never a conflict or an issue, but they just had very different ideas about what they wanted to do with their estates. And so we see things that happen like that, which in Europe you would never see. But so starting on that, I wanted to maybe get your view, Vince, on, because in the area of estate planning, we had talked in our last session about very briefly about something called multiple wills. And this was something that was asked to me at the coffee shop because people were wondering what the heck I was talking about, because it's sort of a hard concept to come to grips with, that how can you have more than one will, right? Because people think you can't have more than one will. So, Vince, can you talk a little bit about this idea of what do we mean when we say multiple wills in the context of estate planning?
Well, multiple wills serve a couple of purposes. The one that's most common now, and this has been the case perhaps in the last 20 years since the Court of Appeal ruled on the applicability or the validity of multiple wills, and that's for the purposes of probate planning.
Now, Vince, let me just step back, because when we talk about probate, this is the whole process by which somebody who is an executor, for example, can take care of the estate of a deceased, correct? That's what we're talking about.
Exactly. So when you have a will, you really don't need the court to give the executor, that is the person you appoint to administer the estate, or your estate, you appoint in your will the person who's going to be your executor or executors. That authority comes from the will itself.
Right, it comes from
However, when you're dealing with third parties in banks, the land registrar with respect to real estate assets, they will not recognize the authority of the executors unless the will has been probated. Sort of the colloquial term or the common known term. They require what's called a certificate of appointment of a state trustee. Unlike an intestacy where there is no will, there's no authority. And so that somebody, and then there's a hierarchical scheme as to who's entitled to apply, would have to apply to the court to be appointed as the, what used to be called the administrator. Now, again, it's the estate trustee without a will. Probate planning is only available where you have a will. So when you apply for probate, it's really applying to the court. There's a process. Notice is given to the beneficiaries and so forth. There's an application submitted to the court, and there is a fee that's charged for that. It's called the estate administration tax. And so that tax is equal to about 1.5% of the value of the estate. It includes, in essence, all assets except real estate located outside of Ontario. That tax can be quite high. If you think of properties that people own now, I mean, a home in Toronto, it's not unusual to have a value of at least $1 million. So that's $15,000 in probate fees.
Yeah, and you're just talking about one home.
One home.
And we oftentimes see clients, and these, you know, generally speaking, there are people who've worked, you know, very, very hard, had great sacrifices over many years. And Vince, I'm sure you have the same thing, but I share with our listeners. I make the joke with a lot of clients that we've all become millionaires. You know, in the old days, a millionaire was a big deal. Maybe it's not such a big deal anymore, but we've all become millionaires because so many people, especially in Toronto, they own a home, or sometimes they bought the little bungalow 35 years ago and they've been renting it out. If they have one or two or three properties, they not only are a millionaire, they're multimillionaires, quite by accident, we'll call it, but or good luck or good investment opportunities. So many people now, in fact, have substantial estates that, as you said, in the past 20 years ago, nobody really thought much about doing in terms of planning. So now you have people who are multimillionaires. You know, and today we're not talking about the lives of the rich and the famous. You know, there's a lot of people who have an investment property or read in the newspapers about people buying condominiums, you know, for rental income and so on. So we have all these people who have properties, and if something happens to them, The will planning is very, very important. And this estate administration cost or fee, I call it a tax.
Well, that's what it is.
Is what it is, 1.5%. It doesn't, it includes all of your assets, you know, including, except for maybe a real estate outside of Ontario. And it includes things like monies and all kinds of things that people have today. So we have, and I guess the other thing to realize is that in the area of real estate, because we know when we talk about wills and estates planning, everything overlaps. It's family law, it's trust law, it's real estate law. You know, in the old days, Vince, even before you were a lawyer, I think, you know, when I first started practicing 40 years ago, I can remember a client of mine would pass away. They would have even a will. Wills were fairly common. They were simple, very, very simple wills. They would have them. And what we would do is we would just register the will on title, and the property would pass to the beneficiary, you know, and that would be the end of it. And, you know, a lot of people are still, you know, people maybe today in their 60s, 70s, and 80s would think it's still like that, you know, back in the old days, and things have changed. So that kind of procedure that used to be so simplistic, in fact, has changed a lot, because in those days, I just want to remind our listeners who may have missed maybe one of our real estate programs, is that we have a real estate system in Ontario that was a registry and a land title system. And the registry system was like the old English system. And so what you used to do, you used to register these documents on title, and that was sort of good enough. And we used to all search titles for 40 years and see what was registered to give our clients a title opinion as to whether they had good title to the property they were buying. But that has changed a lot, because the land title system, which also existed but was not used as much 40 years ago, has now become really the method of land registration for all new subdivisions. And in the background, the government of Ontario has been converting all these registry properties into land titles, and people don't even know about it. So what Vince was just talking about, in the context of somebody passing away today, they may not be able to transfer that property. Probably they won't be able to transfer the property like we did in the old days, but just registering a will, right? That's not the way it works anymore. You have to go to estate administration, which means you have to apply to court. So this becomes, that's where we have the gotcha moment, right? It's not like you can say, well, I'm just not going to bother or whatever. And you have to pay that 1.5% on all of your assets, essentially, right? I mean, Vince, that's what it is. It's all of your assets except for real estate outside of Ontario, right? I mean, so if you had the money sitting in bank accounts and everything, you have to disclose it. And what Vince is also talking about is the very lengthy forms you have to fill out, right? It's quite extensive. There are all kinds of penalties for people who don't tell the truth. And my experience has been, I don't know if Vince has seen it, but I found that the government is auditing these files. They're asking you, you know, if you file something, on what basis did you do it, and what's your backup information? So sometimes there's people who feel that, you know, they can be cunning or sly or whatever and try to avoid the application, or word to the wise is sufficient. So now we have, you know, we know that the government wants its share on this stuff. So Vince, so multiple wills, stepping back to multiple wills. So we have a single will, and now we have an Ontario court case that decided, yeah, you can have something called a multiple will, because really what you're doing is just telling the whole world who can deal with the assets of the deceased. So just briefly, maybe remind our viewers, it's multiple wills. So why would we use a multiple will? What's the purpose of it?
So just getting back, you know, part of your estate planning involves, you know, all the more reasons why you want a will. Because the will ensures that you're leaving your assets to who you want to leave them to.
Right.
There's income tax planning opportunities and probate planning opportunities, which you don't have if you don't have a will. And so with multiple wills, as I indicated, there are certain assets that do require probate, the certificate, in order to give the third party assurance that the executor is in fact legitimate and can in fact deal with the asset without any repercussions to that party relying on it. But there are certain assets that don't require probate. And the most common asset is share in a private corporation. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if you have a corporation, most likely if you have a business, it's likely to be incorporated in the sense that you're carrying on your business through ABC Corporation, in which you are likely the sole director and officer, and you and maybe family members may be shareholders.
And Vince, it's also true, not just people who are in business, a lot of people who may have, a simple example, a 15 or 20 unit apartment building, right? Small apartment buildings, very often they're not held personally, they're held through a company, right?
Exactly. So they're investments, which include business and properties and so forth, that may be held in a corporation. And that value is really reflected in the shares of the deceased person. There was a court decision that came out about 20 years ago, which confirmed that you can have more than one will. That is, you can apply for probate under the legislation with a will that is limited to certain assets. There's nothing wrong with doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So inevitably, you're going to have assets do require probate. Maybe not, but in most cases, there are some. So what you're trying to do is take out as much as you can out of the assets that are included in probate and put them into another will. To the extent that those assets don't require probate, you don't need to include them in the will that you're applying for probate. You can keep them out and put them into a separate will. So that's why we call it multiple wills. You'll have a primary will. I normally call it primary will, which mm-hmm. is assets that require probate. They're included in that primary will. The assets that don't require probate go into the secondary will, the non-probate will. And those assets most commonly consist of shares in private corporations, receivables, and certain assets held in trust, personal property. And so those
things
assets
like maybe
will,
jewelry,
automobiles. You don't need probate for automobiles.
How about artwork?
Artwork would be one. Well, to the extent that whoever is purchasing it will rely on the executor. I mean, it's possible that if it's going to an auction house, they may require something more formal. So you got to be careful there.
Mm-hmm.
But in most cases, personal property, jewelry and artwork, furniture, contents of the home can pass on without probate. So the beauty of that is you are now, again, taking out from the primary will, the probate will, mm-hmm. assets, which reduces the value that's going to be probated or subject to that tax. So you're reducing the tax. So if you're only including, let's say, real estate or shares in public companies, as opposed to shares in your own business or real estate holdings that you have held through a corporation, the savings should be quite significant. And so that's what we mean when we refer to multiple wills. But they're also used in another context, which you've sort of forgotten,
mm-hmm.
where you have assets in other jurisdictions.
Correct.
It's not uncommon.
Yeah, because many people in Canada, I think it's a fair comment, many people in Canada have properties outside of Canada, in the United States, in Italy. Just this past week, I had a couple from Germany who've been here for many years, have a place in Germany, England, large English, Irish groups of people from the Caribbean. I had a client of mine from the Caribbean had property in the Caribbean. So we have a lot of people in Canada who have had connections because they've immigrated here. And very time, for many reasons, either inherited or bought or developed or did whatever in their home jurisdiction, and they have these properties. And so this underlines the idea of multiple wills. Also something that when you talk to your lawyer here in Canada, you have to really disclose everything because you have to work with your lawyer in case there are special issues that need to be addressed. For example, if you own the home in Italy, should you have a separate will? Do you need it? Do you not need it? How's it going to be dealt with? Or in the United States and so on and so forth. So the multiple wills is not just for inside of Canada, but then you have to be very careful how you draft the wills inside of Canada too, right? I mean, If you want, for some reason, if you wanted, for example, your home in South Africa to go some family there, you have to make sure that you plan for that.
Yeah, and you can certainly draft the will to limit it to your Canadian assets. Mm-hmm. And that, again, supports further the idea of having wills for probate planning purposes where you're putting, let's say, your shares in private companies in one will and all your probate assets in another will. Because Correct. We've been doing that before for years with respect to Canadian assets, non-Canadian assets. So, yes, the will should be drafted that way, but the client must remember to have a will drawn up in that other jurisdiction. Yes. Otherwise, you have an intestacy issue, and that's governed, by conflicts laws, typically by the domicile of the person. So inadvertently, that asset may end up coming back to Ontario if they do pass away and they don't have a separate will dealing with the assets in the foreign jurisdiction. So it requires a coordinated approach between the lawyer in Ontario and the lawyer in the other jurisdiction.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. The reverse side, I had a client yesterday who came in who is not Canadian. She lives in the Mideast, but she has assets here in Canada. And what she wanted to make sure was that the assets that she had here in Canada would go to the people who live here in Canada that she wanted to benefit and not back in her home jurisdiction, because her home jurisdiction has rules that are very different than our own. It's in the Mideast. And so she wanted to make sure that the property and the monies that she had here, which were a decent amount. Everybody's a millionaire, as I said. But she wanted to make sure that the people she wanted to prefer here in Canada would do that. And so she's not even a resident of Canada, but she came here to do a will. Of course, we advised her that she had to make sure in her home jurisdiction that she did whatever she had to do. But here in Canada, she wanted to make sure. And that was... that was an interesting situation because she doesn't live here, right? She's not a citizen, whatever, but she owns property, which is permitted.
Well, when you have persons who are resident in multiple jurisdictions or they have properties, we have what is called a conflicts of law regime, which dictates, different elements of the will. For instance, the validity of the will, the inherent... enforceability of the will, if you will, the formalities of how it's signed and so forth. But the basic rule is that the law of the jurisdiction where the real estate is located, mm-hmm. which is internationally known as immovables, if you will, governs how that's dealt with. So if your client had real estate in Ontario, she could conceivably have a will drawn up in her home country. But it would have to comply with respect to real estate with Ontario laws. Even if she was what we call domiciled in her Mideast country, right. She had citizenship, that was the governing law for her in terms right. of her personal affairs, that real estate would be governed by Ontario law. So that's a classic case where you would want an Ontario will to deal with Ontario real estate assets.
Now, Vince, you've raised another issue by another interesting point, and this is something that we used to see quite a bit over my 40 years of practice, where people had real estate abroad, and we would often say, well, you know what, because of this conflict of laws, international private conflict of laws issue, you should really make sure that you do a will in Germany, I'll use Germany, in Germany to cover, because it's a European system, and yada, 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 and the Canadian will won't be applied. But recently there's been changes on that, and I think you're familiar with them. The European Union has adopted a set of rules, and this, I must tell you, my European clients, and whether they're from Germany or Ireland or Italy and so on, were very surprised because it's sort of something that went under the radar. So, Vince, can we talk a little bit about this? Because about the European Union, I know it's a fairly new regime, but would it be fair for me to say that the European Union has decided that even if I, for example, am a citizen of Italy and I have a house in Italy, but I am domiciled, and for want of a better word, the word that you used, let's say, but I really live in Canada, I'll call it, But if I make a will in Canada, it'll be recognized in, for example, Italy, even though they have a forced heirship regime. Is that a fair comment, or what do you think about that?
You know, you raise an interesting point. My understanding is that it should include, you know, the ability to leave the assets to whomever you wish, provided you fall within certain criteria in terms of which law governs. I believe, although I'm a bit rusty, I have to admit, I think nationality or residency may be one criteria which allows you to adopt. If, for instance, a person's resident in Canada, they can use Canadian law.
Right. For example, it'd be somebody who maybe has immigrated here and they're probably a Canadian citizen or at very least a landed immigrant here.
But I'm not clear on whether the forced heirship laws would be ousted, notwithstanding the treaty. My understanding, there was still a gray area there. And I'm not 100% sure that even if the European regulation, if you will, applied Ontario law, that would trump Italian forced heirship laws with respect to any real estate located in Italy. I'm not entirely convinced.
Yeah, well, it's a good point you raised, because this issue in the past year has come up in a couple of occasions. And matter of fact, I was dealing with a couple of lawyers in Italy on this point. And they're also vaguely familiar, I will call it. They're aware of the new rules that if you are, you know, if I'm a person who is domiciled in Canada and I have property in Italy, I'll use Italy as an example, could be anywhere in Europe, because I was domiciled here, that the will that I prepare here would govern and would oust the forced heirship regime. But I agree with you, there's still these question marks, because I think that the key issue is whether or not, and I don't think it's clear quite yet, is whether or not you are a national of that country or not, if they're going to distinguish or not distinguish. And but I think the intention was that, in fact, that European law would not apply, but we're not seeing the practical application. And once again, it just underlines the importance of also having a lawyer here who can communicate with someone overseas so that these things are addressed. So as you just said, once again, multiple wills may be important. At the end of the day, you might say, you know what, should I or should I not? Because I had one client of mine said, gee, Joe, if I pass away tomorrow, in my will here in Ontario, where I've lived for so many years, is good. I actually don't want my nephews and nieces in Italy to, let's say in this case, there's a gentleman who did not have children and did not have a spouse. And he said, no, I don't want my nephews and nieces to inherit anything that I have in Italy. I want to prefer my nephews and nieces here in Canada. But people, it's an example where the other way around, and this is the conversation I've had with a lawyer in Italy, is, look, I've got a situation that this, like this and this. And so we're still not finalized, but he says he thinks that even though he's still an Italian citizen and he's a Canadian citizen and he has property, but he lives in Ontario, he thinks, this is the interesting issue. You know, the old joke is you ask a lawyer a question, never give you a straight answer. But unfortunately, this especially particularly a new situation. But if you're a person who has property outside the jurisdiction, it's something to really think about and try to address. And he would be very happy now that his Ontario will would govern. And that would be the end of it, for want of a better word.
Well, and again, maybe I'm speaking, there could be a case out there, but I doubt it. But I think it'll have to sort of
work its way through.
Yeah. There's probably going to be a case on it. I'm sure there will be. And once we have some guidance by the courts, then perhaps we can give a more definitive approach. I would tend to go with the cautious approach and agree with you in involving counsel in Italy, and perhaps go with multiple wills just the same.
Yeah,
you
just
know,
to be careful.
Just
right?
to be careful. And again, you know, very often the assets in the other jurisdiction are very limited. Maybe a piece of real estate, a bank account.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think it's a very, very difficult task to undertake to, you know, have that separate will done. Powers of attorney, I'm almost certain that, you know, they're not going to recognize the Ontario ones in Italy or in any other jurisdiction, or won't be consistent. They're certainly not consistently applied. So I always advise clients to have powers of attorney prepared in the jurisdiction where they have assets, because again,
there's an inconsistent
application, yeah, and they may not be recognized.
Yeah, it's a very good advice, Vince, on that one, because oftentimes I get clients say, well, you know, I want a power of attorney, whatever. And you're 100% right. The powers of attorney in particular, that should be done by the in the home jurisdiction. Sometimes the embassies and the consulate actually offer that service through their offices here to help people with that.
But you got to make sure, though, that when you're drawing up these wills in the other jurisdiction, that they expressly provide that they do not revoke your Ontario will.
That's correct.
And same with powers of attorney. So there has to be a communication between the two. Because if you do that, because again, it's the last will that governs. And you can have a will drawn up in Italy. If it's not limited to the assets there, you may inadvertently revoke the will here. And same with and powers of attorney. Well, you've got to make sure they're communicating with each other.
Now, Vince, what if I'm a smart guy here and I say, you know what, I got $10 million worth of whatever of assets and so on. I'm going to do a multiple will here in Canada. And in the will that's not probated, I'm going to put in a clause. I want my lawyer to put in a clause that whatever my executor wants not to be in my primary will, that's what it is. Okay. So I'm going to be a smart guy. I'm going to basically exclude all of my assets from my primary will by some clause like that. And I'll just avoid the state administration costs completely. What do you think about that idea?
Well, going back to multiple wills, when you're preparing them, at least for me, you have to be specific as to what assets are passing through each will. I mean, I've taken that approach. You have to identify what's going through each will. Some lawyers are more conservative in their approach, like me, where you list specifically what class of assets can go through one will and what goes through the other will.
Correct.
But there are wills out there, and there are practitioners who have drafted these types of wills, which give the executors the discretion to determine which asset goes into which will. And there was a court decision, there was another one that challenges that, although I can't say it's an actual challenge in every case, but there is a decision out there that the judge indicated that trustees cannot pick and choose. And without getting into the technical details for our listeners, mm-hmm. He equated wills as trusts, and under trust laws, you can't, you have to have what's called certainty of what is subject to that trust, what are the assets going into that trust, and you can't let trustees or executors pick and choose what goes into which will. That's the executor. And if the executor leaves it loose like that, where he or she lets the executors decide, that runs afoul of certain trust laws. Then there was another decision that seemed to contradict that, but I think it was more of a technicality in terms of it's really not for the judge to review that issue when the will is just being applied for probate. If somebody wants to challenge the will and argue that those provisions aren't valid, it's really a question of construction of the will or interpretation, and that should be left for another day. So as it stands now, that first decision where the judge ruled that executors can't be given that power to pick and choose, it's being appealed to the Court of Appeal, and that hearing expected to be heard in the spring of next year. So hopefully we'll get some guidance from the top Ontario court on that issue soon.
Yeah, so caution, again, is warranted because of these differences, and sometimes one cannot be overly aggressive in terms of the estate planning.
I don't think the Court of Appeal is going to give guidance on every issue or on that very aspect. I think the Court of Appeal is likely going to decide the issue of whether a judge who's reviewing a will for probate purposes should go beyond his or her task, which is to ensure that there's testamentary intent and that the will's been validly signed. That is, signed by the testator at the end with two witnesses. That's it. I don't think it's going to decide the issue of whether you can have those clauses per se. Where that could become an issue is where you have different beneficiaries in each will who stand to gain if one is invalidated. And at least with me, I won't draft wills, multiple wills, where you have different beneficiaries in each, or be very hesitant to. So
yes,
absent that, I think that could practically settle the issue.
Right? Now, Vince, you mentioned there the use of multiple wills, and we had discussed just now the especially the European Union situation and so on. And I think there's another important point that in the past was maybe not considered as relevant, but we now have an agreement with the European Union, fairly new also this one, about the exchange of information. Not just on the question of validity of wills, but exchange of information. There's a protocol that has been formally entered into and ratified, particularly with the European Union and Canada, with the exchange of financial information, which is more and more readily available. What do you think about that issue? I mean, how people look at that. Is that going to be a concern or not?
Well, as a taxpayer, I'm all for it. I think Canada is a haven for money launderers, and I'm all for it. And I, you know, always counsel clients to ensure that they are declaring everything. And I think it's good, and I think it just confirms that you should be reporting everything and ensuring that you're making all the proper filings, you or your executors. And that's why, you know, if it's not the lawyer, the accountants will ensure that the proper filings and declarations are made. So, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I think it just means ensuring that there's compliance on both sides of the border.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. Many years ago, before this formal exchange of information that occurred, I had a lady from England who had a flat, as they call it. It would be like a condo here in Canada that she had owned in London for years, and she had rental income from it. And she had never filed income tax returns. She lived in Canada. She had come from the UK, and she had never filed her rental income here in Canada. And for some reason, we never really were sure how, but somehow the fact that she may have a link to the UK came to the attention of the Canada Revenue Agency, the CRA, and out of the blue, they issued her a letter and said, Mrs. Smith, information has come to us that you have a rental property in the UK, blah, 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 blah. And she was forced to... she had not realized, she said, that she had this obligation to do so because she had filed her UK returns, but she had not filed the income and expenses, the information on her UK return in her Canadian income tax return. And she had to refile, and she was assessed because the tax in Canada was higher than in the UK. So even though it was primarily taxed in the UK, the income that she got... was at a lower tax rate than in Canada. So she had to pay the difference. She had to pay a fine, penalties for not filing. And she learned a lesson. And this was quite a few years ago now, and that was before. And that was a classic case. And the CRA has readily admitted it here that they get cold calls from people in these situations, friends, family, and usually for disgruntled family, friends, and ex-business associates, and they follow up on the leads. It's easy money for them. So, you know, I would never want somebody to have that kind of power. So it's best to do things in a proper way and to, you know, to do things as we go on. So we've talked a little bit about Europe. We've talked about multiple wills. But we've sort of sidestepped probably the elephant in the room, as I call it. And people... we'll know who I'm talking about. The elephant in the room following Pierre Elliott, the late Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, used to say that if there's in a bed, there's a mouse and an elephant, and the elephant rolls over, the mouse is forced to act. And of course, the elephant in the room here is the United States, and we're the mouse here in Canada. So Vince, You know, so many people in Canada have links to the U.S. It's really quite amazing. There are so many Americans or ex-Americans who live here. We see people get married across the border. We're so close to the border. We have so many links to the United States in particular in terms of trade and personal relationships. So I wanted to talk a little bit now about the whole U.S. situation and estate planning, because this is an area that people think is very nebulous, you know. I mean, if we're from Europe, we appreciate it. But actually, the connection with the United States is even bigger, isn't it? It's just a huge number of people who have links and family in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the U.S. tax regime is very, very what we call extraterritorial. It goes well beyond its borders. Mm. You know, in Canada, when you talk about declaring in your income and you had your English client run into bit of a problem with the CRA. In Canada, you're taxed based on residency and the source of income. But residency is the key, because if you are a resident Canadian, then you're taxed on your worldwide income. If you're not resident, then it depends on the source of the income that's from Canada. Whereas the U.S., they have a very broad regime where you're subject to a whole variety of taxes. And I'm not giving any U.S. tax advice, just from the general knowledge and having, you know, worked with U.S. tax practitioners. Their taxes are based on, you know, a number of factors, primarily citizenship, and I guess the green card status, which is sort of a permanent residence scenario.
If you need someone who's a landed immigrant, they tax you on both cases on worldwide income.
So if you're working there and you have a green card, you know, you're living there. A lot of times you have Canadians who marry a U.S. Citizen and they get a green card, maybe not a citizenship yet. Or there's a presence, you know, if you're there in the States for a period of time. And that has a lot of consequences, because you may be a U.S. citizen, not realize that. Because if you were born to U.S. parents, you may in certain circumstances, even if you never set foot in the U.S., be a U.S. citizen. So that brings you into that whole U.S. tax regime, which has implications in terms of, you know, filing requirements while you're alive and potentially being subject to U.S. taxes, and also estate taxes on your death. And again, you may have never set foot in the U.S.
Yeah, Vince, this is a good point, because as you said, on a very simplistic level, I'll use a simple example. I mean, in the past, the U.S., I think, was let's say, more strict. But let's say I wanted to give my son $50,000 or something to help him buy a house or something like that. Here in Canada, we don't have gift tax, right? We don't have any special tax like death tax. People think about it. In Europe, they have it. They have. But here in Canada, I think from the year before I started practicing, 1978, 79, something called the Succession Law Reform Act, as I recall, or so something like that. They basically eliminated gift and what I call gift or death tax.
Estate tax.
And gift tax. But in the United States, that's not the case. They have a different regime. They have what we used to have still.
Yeah, they still have estate taxes and gift taxes, and generational gift tax tax skipping legislation, and so they pretty well capture most scenarios where, you know, if you're trying to get rid of property even during your lifetime,
right?
You could be referring to generational gifting. Generational tax skipping regime, and so even if you try to reduce the amount of taxes or assets that you own during your lifetime, you know, even gifts made during your lifetime are subject to gift tax.
And this is
at the state and national level.
Yeah, so, and this is something that here in Canada, all of us here in Canada would scratch our heads, because if somebody used the example of $50,000, I forget what the U.S. limit is right now, but it's not that high. But let's say it's $50,000 or whatever. I want to give my son $50,000. I have to pay tax on that gift which is something that is so strange and foreign to us here in Canada because it's outside of our regimes. And yet, as you said, there are a lot of people here, and there's also a lot of Americans living here in Canada, or children of Americans who are Americans. I remember once a client of mine said, well, my who was a U.S. citizen and was here, and she said, well, my children are not U.S. citizens. And I said, why? And she said, well, they don't have a passport. And once again, people tend to not understand that being a citizen does not necessarily mean holding a passport. A passport's really a travel document, right? I mean, more than anything. But so, and she hadn't appreciated, and, you know, she came up to Canada in her 20s after going to university, met her husband, she was here, they had 3 or 4 kids, and she said, no, she said, my kids aren't their citizens, they don't have passports. And I said, no, they are citizens. She said, what do you mean they're citizens? I said, well, you know, they're citizens, you know, like, because you were born in the United States and you didn't come to, you know, there's a, as Vince knows too, there's a whole bunch of rules relating to citizenship. I said, all these kids have to do is make an application and they're going to get their U.S. passports, but they're technically speaking citizens. And so I remember this one client of mine said, well, how would they ever know? And I said, well, you're traveling across the border, and it's very funny because people go to great lengths to try to not deal with issues, right? So very often, a lot of American citizens here in Canada have Canadian and U.S. passports. And actually, in the old days, you know, the border people were a little bit loosey-goosey. But today, both American ports of entry and Canadian ports of entry, if you're a Canadian citizen or an American citizen, you have to have an American passport or Canadian passport to enter into Canada. I mean, respectively. So it's not, you know, we've talked in other programs about people who had dual nationality, didn't bother with a Canadian passport. No, those days are gone. You fly into Canada, you better, before you leave, you better have your Canadian passport because that's what's required. So if you're a Canadian citizen, you have American citizenship, American passport. And I said, well, you can imagine you cross the border and you have your Canadian passport and it says, born in New York City. You know, with the rules in the United States are similar. They're going to know you're a citizen. And if you're with your kids and it says born in Toronto, you know, the U.S. Border person would probably say, well, how come your children aren't traveling with their U.S. passports? An example, right? And she hadn't realized that, in fact, her kids were U.S. citizens. And this becomes important because, Vince, again, maybe you have an estate planning issue, don't you, if you have a U.S. citizen?
Well, yeah, not only that. I have situations where you have a Canadian spouse and a U.S. A Canadian citizen spouse and a U.S. citizen spouse owning a home.
Correct. This is very
common. Well, the U.S. taxes, the capital, they have capital gains regime too, but in addition to their, you know, gift tax
and estate taxes,
they don't recognize a principal residence exemption, which is something that's available to Canadians. And I think most of our listeners know about that. If you have a principal residence, you know, home that you ordinarily occupy, and you're only allowed one for each spousal unit, if you will, then that house is generally exempt from capital gains tax. It's one of the few freebies we have still.
Yes.
Okay. And the U.S. doesn't recognize that. So I'm getting scenarios where you have, you know, a spouse, Canadian citizen, and a U.S. citizen spouse. They own a home in Toronto. You know what the prices are like here. And, you know, they suddenly find out that, hey, my spouse's interest is subject to capital gains taxes in the U.S.
What am I going to do about it?
There may not be credits for that either. So that is a problem. So, well, the solution is to slowly transfer the house over to the Canadian citizen and set up a trust. But that's a whole other area.
Yeah.
Have to be aware that that is an immediate issue.
Yeah. And I'm going to say, we're talking about something, Vince, that is, we'll call it very basic to so many of our listeners, owning their family home. That little fact becomes so important to deal with because, as you said, and we said earlier in our broadcast, everybody's a millionaire today, right? So the values are what they are. They're huge.
Yeah, and so add to that the other issues that come up on death with respect to the estate tax. There needs to be planning. A lot of people, what they're doing is they're renouncing their citizenship, but that's a long and expensive process. And
I have a few clients.
And there's filings requirement, as you know.
Filings requirements, and just to tell our readers, like, somebody who renounced, it's almost treated like an act of treason in the United States, right, to renounce your citizenship. Sometimes it's not so bad. Sometimes you have people who have been born in the United States for some reason at a very early age, but don't really have a link. They're treated a little bit differently, but they're forced to file their income tax returns usually at least 3 years back, maybe five. And there's all, as you said, there's all kinds of filing requirements to do that. And of course, there's also the hassle that when next time you cross the border with your Canadian passport and shows you were born in New York City, you're going to get the friendly visa, the border officer saying, where's your U.S. passport? And he'll say, and then you'll have to say, well, I renounced my American citizenship, right? They don't treat you very nicely, unfortunately, at the port of entry, and they're gods, and you just have to take their attitude, and that's the way it is. And all this issue of the U.S. stuff is important. Now, Vince, is there any savings grace? Like some people have said to me, well, you know, I saw something in the paper where, you know, if you don't have a big estate, it's not going to make any difference. There's some exemptions for this estate tax that is in the U.S., the death tax, as I call it. There have been some changes on that recently, haven't there been?
Well, under the Trump sponsored, if you will, budget that went through the tax legislation that went through earlier this year, they increased what's called the exemption, lifetime exemption on estate taxes for U.S. citizens. I believe it's around $11
million,
the couple can share it. So effectively, between the husband and wife or partners, if you will, it's $22
million. Mm-hmm.
However, if you are a Canadian citizen, you're not a U.S. person, not subject to U.S. taxes, you're still subject to estate taxes with respect to real estate in the United States and any stocks you own directly in U.S. corporations.
Right.
And so by way of a tax treaty between Canada and the U.S., you're entitled to a proportionate share of that exemption based on the value of the assets you have in the U.S. versus the assets you have worldwide. All right. So if 20% of all of your assets are located in the U.S., then you are entitled to 20% of that $11 million credit. All right.
Right.
However, there's a sunset clause, as I understand it, and that will go back down in 2023.
And very often in the past, if we're dealing with a historical situation, there have been years when that figure has varied wildly. And in some years, I remember one year during, George Bush's years.
George W.
That it was zero. Yeah. There was no exemption whatsoever. So you can just appreciate how unpredictable that is, because it depends on when you die, for want of a better word, as to what the level of tax relief may be.
I can't see it being eliminated altogether again. I can see it being reduced, perhaps, maybe down to $5 million, maybe probably not less than that. So I think you have to go on the assumption that the $11 million is not going to be there forever. And as it is now, it probably covers most people. But I think over time, if that's dropped, then you may want to consider certain planning opportunities to help avoid that tax altogether. And there's ways to do that.
Yeah, I think, and the other thing, Vince, that I know some people have read and they've said to me, they said they've heard that that the United States is considering actually going to the worldwide OECD model, which is what we have here in Canada, that you pay taxes in the jurisdiction where you live, right? It seems fairly simple approach, and it's usually what happens, maybe except for real estate, everywhere in the world. And the United States, apparently the U.S. Senate, is considering that. But if we look at what happens in U.S. politics, I wouldn't hold my breath on it occurring, because the United States, together with, I believe it's Eritrea, are the only two countries in the world that tax on the basis of citizenship or landed immigrant status in addition to everything else. So for those, anyone who thinks, well, the Americans are going to change the law because the U.S. Senate is discussing it, you know, don't hold your breath. I think that the real, you know, the lesson to be learned is think carefully about your situation. It's important to get proper legal advice and to carefully consider what you have and so on. I always tell people that you're not coming to a lawyer to do a will or a power of attorney. You're coming actually for estate planning, to do the whole situation, how to organize your affairs. That's the real value.
And as you indicated, you know, the laws can change. And so I always recommend or remind my clients that they should do a review every 3 to 5 years because the law changes. Very and good. We can't be expected to look through the crystal ball and know what's going to happen 5 years down the road.
Great. That's a fantastic piece of advice. And on that note, I want to thank Vince very much, wish him and his family and all of our listeners a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And we hope that you found the program valuable. And we really have to thank Vince for his contribution. I'm sure I'll get lots of comments at the coffee shop about everything we were talking about today. Thank
Hopefully
you, Vince.
Hopefully good ones.
Yeah,
okay.
All good ones. All
thank
for
you,
the good. Thank you, Vince.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.